I can ask, what were you surprised the most about PI? What are you gonna take away with you of this place? Because this place is very peculiar for a number of reasons. And as long as you bring with you all the special things that you like the most, you also should bear in mind this peculiarness, okay? And don't think that any research institution in the world looks like this, because it looks more like, I don't know who of you has read Pinocchio, but it looks more like the little town of toys where Pinocchio ends up at some point and keeps thinking, oh, that can be true. And in fact, it's not true. In the end, he gets eaten up almost. But that won't happen to you. But no, seriously, can you pose these kind of large questions, or it wouldn't be a mess? Everybody would start. Yes, so what were you excited the most about this place? The architecture, the fact that it rains inside, the fact that we have a foosball table, maybe not because you haven't seen it, or the atmosphere between the researchers, or the area of research selected? Please.
I think it's interesting that there's such a diverse range of developed areas. So it's not just like very strong quantum or very strong relativity, it's just tons of different developed areas. And so there's so much opportunity for just theoretical physics and connecting those different areas.
Very good point. That's actually a very important point. And I'm glad that it looks that way, because it's an effort to try to make this place as broad and various as possible. However, in the overall range of the theoretical physics, it is actually true that the place spans a very little corner, little in terms of numbers of researchers working on it in the world. And for instance, when it comes to theoretical physics, the areas which are explored the most are areas such as condensed matter physics or particle physics. And these two areas, there are efforts to try to start developing these areas here as well, but for instance, they are not very represented at the moment. So when you go to a general university and you go to the theoretical physics department, most of the people in there will be working either on statistical mechanics in condensed matter systems or in particle physics. It won't be that obvious to find all these people that work in string theory or in quantum gravity or even worse, in foundations. There's people here working in foundations of quantum mechanics, which basically it's almost the only place in the world where you can find even permanent researchers focusing on this. You might find the philosophers, actually, in philosophy departments, discussions of that sort. But when it comes to a physics institution, it's the only place. So I'm glad that you gave the idea of broadness, but please keep in mind that physics is much broader than what it is in here. So when in 1 or 2 years' time you come to that point of choosing a program for university,
my advice would be to be as broad as possible, as open as possible at the beginning. Don't feel the need to go straight for black holes at the day first of university, but try to go for a program that is going to give you solid, broad background, because that will make it easier for you to make a more consistent choice later on, and to have more tools to develop that choice later on. So, there was another thing that so somebody else has any other comments about perimeter, things that he liked the most? So another thing is that research institutions in the world are more, so first of all, typically you are in a position where you teach and do research. So perimeter is peculiar also in the fact that here researchers have no administrative duties, no teaching duties, they can focus entirely on research. This is also very rare. It's much more likely to find a situation where a university, there's a department where people teach and do research at the same time. So that's also another thing that you have to keep in mind, that is not so flashy, typically. There's many beautiful institutions, but once again, perimeter stands out for a number of things, including like the sauna of the squash court. You won't find a sauna in the average physics department. No, I'm saying these things because I know that among you, I think you guessed too, that among you there are many people that will end up choosing physics, right? And possibly trying to even develop a career in physics. And so it's important to know that not all the places look like this, right? I think it's so that it's important that in your motivation to do physics, physics is the real reason, not coming to a place like PI. Because you might be in a place which is different, but still, if your main motivation was physics, you'll be happy nevertheless. Okay. So I think it's maybe it comes from reading too much Pinocchio, but I think it's important to. So I came to the decision of doing, so you're like 16, 17, so when I say in 1 or 2 years' time you'll make this decision, that more or less corresponds to most of you, I guess. Or is there anybody that is starting next fall?
You guys are starting next fall. You have decided already the program? You haven't decided yet?
Physics.
You're going to yeah. So, and I guess that you guys are reading a lot of popular books and things like this, which I think is very useful. I know that I'm supposed to give advice for popular books as well, and I think that there's a number of them that are quite attractive out there. Maybe I won't give a broad advertisement like this. If somebody has really is interested, then I can talk, but I won't give broad advertisement about this. But I will only say one thing, that with respect to the old, so for instance, the first popular book I read, I think, was Asimov, The Book of Physics, right? That's early, middle 70s, maybe. So something has changed in the way popular books are written. So the popular books like Asimov's, it was based on what we saw. It was based on the experimental evidence, on phenomenology, and it was describing the theories that were more or less precisely agreeing with the experiments. At some point, a turn was taken, and most popular books nowadays describe just the theoretical ideas, which makes them very fascinating, but also even deceiving from time to time. So more modern physical books describes just theoretical ideas that might be beautiful, but they have no correspondence with what we see, no reasons to actually be true from an experimental point of view, just at the same footage as what we really understand in terms of confirmed experiments. So with more modern popular books, there's this extra ingredient that you have to, with your own head, discern between when the writer is describing what are just ideas and what is truly research that has been confirmed. And the topic of my talk, of course, will be thoroughly just ideas, because quantum gravity in particular is the domain that has become famous for this, for just giving the opportunity to do almost science fiction instead of just research. And the reason for this is precisely in the fact that there's no experimental evidence. So with respect to the origin of science, observe something, cook up an explanation for it, derive some prediction from your explanation, and test this prediction against the new experiments. If there's a matching between the two of them, then you can say, oh, maybe this is an interesting explanation for the phenomenon. This was 4 centuries ago, the beginning. Unfortunately, this has worked tremendously well in these many centuries until this point of quantum gravity. And I'm sure that you have read or heard in these 2 weeks here why and how this came about to be, and I'll try to give you an idea. I assume that you guys have been already briefed on things like quantum mechanics or special and general relativity. And so I will try to pinpoint aspects of why these two theories are so hard to put together and why there's difficulties in finding experimental evidence to guide our understanding. Those were my words of advice, I have to say. And so as far as I'm concerned, I studied in Rome. So I did, in fact, those words of advice come also from my personal experience, because, so I was very interested into astrophysics, into cosmology. So I even wanted to take astronomy, actually. Then for logistical reasons, it was easier to just stay in Rome. I ended up taking physics, and I was extremely happy of that, because then along the years, I realized that there were many more things that I was interested in that maybe a very narrow choice right from the beginning wouldn't make it harder for me. So like when I was at the 3rd year of university, I realized that actually there were other things interesting me.
And 3rd year of university for men meant like 21. So it's quite a few years ahead of you still. And you might still change your mind a lot. So that's why I'm saying try to keep your possibilities open. And then to take this direction of quantum gravity, as usual, there has to be one event, right, that clicks you in one direction. So what happened was that I was in Italy, you do a master thesis in which you are supposed to do some research even before graduating. It's supposed to be like between 6 months and a year. Now things also have changed. So back in the day, I can't be that old, right? Anyway, back in the day, 10 years ago almost? No, 10 years ago, that's when I started, right? In 2002, when I did my finished my undergrad, I was supposed to look for an advisor for my research thesis and do some research with him before graduating. And at that time, I had come back to the idea of having studying something that had to do with the cosmos, but I had realized that more than the astrophysical stuff, that the classical stuff, I was interested in the quantum aspects of it and this problem of trying to merge these two descriptions of the world. And so I was looking for a thesis advisor, and at some point there was this there was a seminar by one of the leading figures in loop. So you guys have heard of loop quantum gravity, string theory. I'm certain you know about string theory a lot. Maybe loop quantum gravity not so well. One of the main figures behind loop quantum gravity is Liz Molin, which you have heard the first night you guys were here. And another one is Carlo Rovelli, who's a friend of his. And that day he was giving a seminar in Rome. So I figured, oh, maybe I should go and listen to this guy and see what that is like. Because I had been to the string theory nest in Rome. And I went like, OK, we're very zealots, if I can say it that way. So and then I went to the seminar in like maybe 45 minutes in advance, because I was very excited. And there was this guy like washing the blackboard, which is something that it's amazing, by the way. And this is, again, something that you won't happen only at PI. You won't find your blackboard nicely washed in the average institution. And so there was this guy washing the blackboards an hour before, which in Rome is something completely unheard of, because Rome's department, you have the walls are like broken and there's pipes coming through. So you can imagine. So I say, hey, are we actually going to have this happening every time, washing the blackboards? Because I thought he was a worker, like an employee that started something new. No, it was Carlo Rovelli, it was the speaker that he was also excited. He was also there 45 minutes before, and he was nicely preparing his blackboard for the talk. And so we became almost friends right away like that. And this brings me to another smaller word of advice, but which I think it's important. So for most people, doing science, doing research is like a mission, okay? So it's like you're very devoted to it. It's your main reason to get up in the morning. I don't know. There's people that are very devoted. There's other people that are very happy of doing this job, but that also see it as a job, okay? So it's something that you want to do, and you want to do in the best of possible ways for your own. So you're not maybe necessarily ready to give up everything else just in order to do your research. And when it comes to this, as in any other job, the colleagues that you have around are important. So there's people that envisage science as just personal research. Everybody thinks on his own, tries to go as far as possible. But I see science as a collective discussion in which all together we try to put our little brains and one kick here, one kick there, we try to make progress. And from this point of view, the possibility of discussing with people with which you find yourself, how can I say, in tune, is very important. It's much more important than you can think of, at least for me. When I'm surrounded by people that I struggle to have discussions with, I'm also not so happy of collaborating with them or keep investigating those issues. So choosing also according to, like you would, I'm sure, in any other job, like this, because of the fact that it's almost an artistic endeavor, sometimes is taken apart. But if you are doing a normal job, like you are selling cars, I don't know, or you are a journalist, you care a lot for the environment of your colleague and how well you find yourself with them. And I think that is something that, in principle, can be considered here as well, when you do research. Because I think that if you can find yourself more at ease with your colleagues, you can do more progress and work more happily. So I think those were enough words of advice. And let me, if the computer starts again, if you haven't sabotaged, you must have. No, no, it's the magic dot. Where's my hope? Here's my hope. Do I have a volunteer? Shall I go quickly? Oh, thank you. What is this? So everybody has heard of string theory. Yes. Everybody has heard of loop quantum gravity. No. Ah, merde. Very good. Okay, then I will talk about what this is like. So, yes, we can talk about these things, in fact. Let me start, though, from sort of the beginning. So if you've read your popular books, or if you have studied already a little bit of fundamental physics, or if you have enjoyed your time here, you have come to realize that there's been huge progress in the understanding of the world in the previous century, in the 20th century, and that this progress has been sort of going along two parallel lines. On the one hand, there were mostly the Germans working on the microscopic world and developing quantum mechanics. On the other hand, there were, again, the Germans working on trying to understand the cosmos. In fact, all those papers are in German, not surprisingly. But then they've been translated. And it's actually very nice to go and read the original papers of the various Einstein, Heisenberg, Bohr. You might think it's boring, but no, it's actually very interesting because the guys had a very nice, deep physical understanding. You will find very few equations. Like, if you want, the concept of general relativity, it's already in Riemann's thesis. So Riemann was a you must have heard of Riemann maybe already, but he was a student of Gauss. Gauss, you have heard of him for sure, and probably the greatest mathematician ever lived. And he had, as a student, Riemann, and as a PhD thesis, he assigned him a problem that then turned out to develop all the necessarily mathematical tools for Einstein's general relativity to be written in mathematical terms. And Riemann's paper is beautiful, and there's one equation in the whole paper. It's a paper in Nature of 1870-something. So going back to see those old things without fancy notation, without many equations, but with a very deep physical understanding of things, it's refreshing, and it's something that I strongly advise to do from time to time. So, and it's funny that more or less they developed at the same time, right? Because Einstein started thinking about general relativity shortly after his important developments of 1905. And by that time, already people had been investigating the consequences of Planck's ideas and so on. So the first 20, 25 years of the 20th century, as you know, were extremely dense and rich with developments, and they brought us to this nice picture where we had a much better, much deeper understanding than before of what were the forces, in particular, what was the force, gravity, and how it was described, keeping the cosmos together and keeping the solar system together, and understanding all those crazy phenomena that were taking place at the microscopic level, at the level of atoms and subatomic particles. The developments of the two theories were completely disjoint, both from a physical perspective, so the physical intuitions behind the two developments, the two theories, were completely disjoint, and mathematically. The mathematics of the two theories were completely disjoint as well. However, people weren't that worried of these. Well, there were people. Einstein itself, he was very worried about quantum mechanics, for instance. He didn't like it at all. But the people weren't so worried about the fact that these theories seem to be successful in spite of the fact of written so differently, because in principle they apply to domains which are so different. Generativity in principle applies to the super huge scales of the cosmos, and quantum mechanics applies to the super small scales of the subatomic particles. In between, there's a huge space where just basically the classical physics that was already quite understood applies. So people didn't fear that, worried about the fact that they don't talk to each other, because it's not obvious that they should overlap. However, these two theories actually extend the range of predictions and of significance far beyond the initial scales that they are used for. For instance, generativity enters at the small scale of this little object, which some of you might know. It's the GPS. Why? Because you have done a special relativity, and so you know that two observers, which are two different inertial observers, so they have a relative speed, constant speed, respect to each other, they measure time in a different way. You're familiar with this, right? I'm sure. What Einstein later realized is that the same thing applies also for observers which are accelerated with respect to each other. So in particular, for our gravitational purposes, what that means is that observers in a different gravitational well will experience time in a different way. And so in particular, this object needs, in order to work, to make a coincidence with four satellites which are up in orbit. These satellites experience a different gravitational force from the Earth than we do. So time in a clock measured by those satellites runs differently than time measured on Earth. So when you want to really know where you are and get those impressive achievements like a precision of a meter that GPS can reach, which then is blocked for military reasons, I think 10 meters in the commercial version. But anyway, in order to achieve that precision, you need to introduce in your in the calculation that the machine is doing the corrections that come from general relativity. Conversely, this is an extremely huge object, right? This is a nebula. I think that's
Isn't that very good? Very good. The reason why that's red,
and the fact that that by being red we are able to tell that that's mostly hydrogen, has to do with quantum mechanics, and you probably already know why. And that's because you know that the energy levels of electrons around the nuclei are quantized. They cannot be at any distance, let me put it that way for simplicity, but they have to be at a fixed distance from the radius, which means that when you ionize the electron from the hydrogen and the electron comes back in, you're going to get always the same amount of energy being released. Electromagnetic energy means wavelength of the photon that is emitted, means color of the photon that is emitted. So the fact that it comes of a single color, it's red for hydrogen, green for nitrogen or oxygen, I can't remember now, has to do ultimately with quantum mechanics. So this huge object knows about quantum mechanics. So there is overlap between the two. There is a need to understand the two theories in a more common language. And this is just, let's say, a superficial discussion of sort of, there might be domains where both theories could apply. There's a sort of philosophical desire to try to have a single language to describe the world. But it goes beyond it. And it goes beyond that in the sense that, for instance, general relativity taken on its own, even though it's a beautiful theory, doesn't quite make sense thoroughly. Because if you poke the theory hard enough, ultimately you're going to end up with meaningless answers from the theory. You might ask what happens if some dust of gas collapses, and the theory will answer you that you will end up forming a nice planet. Or if you have enough gas collapsing, you will end up at a smaller radius, higher density, and then Nuclear physics will tell you that at those energy actually start nuclear reactions, and so you're going to end up with a star. But if you keep poking generativity, at some point it tells you, oh, look, you know what? If you continue this way, you're just going to collapsing forever until you reach a point of infinite density. And that doesn't quite make much sense. So sometimes it is said that the theory carries the seeds of its own destruction, in the sense that in the theory itself, without adding anything else, I can ask questions which give me infinite as an answer. And every time you get infinite as an answer, you might be suspicious. Like when you do your fractions, if you divide by zero accidentally, at some point you know that you're going to screw up and get an infinite at the end. So it's a sign that maybe you've done something wrong. And I will tell you along the talk why we think that a way to improve then generativity and avoiding these infinite meaningless answers is precisely to introduce quantum mechanics. So probably you have seen already these kind of pictures. So the idea that Einstein was trying to implement with generativity was, after special relativity, the laws of physics are the same for all the inertial observers and everybody agrees on the speed of light. Then you try to move one step forward and say, actually, the laws of physics should be the same for any observer, regardless whether it's inertial or not. And this is what led him to this equivalence principle, and then to this idea that actually gravity might be described as the, instead of as a force, as the curvature of space-time. You can draw a simple example to understand why that idea is powerful and makes sense. You can draw it if you have chalk, which I do here, loads of chalk. So imagine that you have two rolling balls, two metallic rolling balls, and these two are charged. First, let's say that they're not charged. So these are moving. This is a plane. Gravity goes that way. Okay, so there's no gravity. So they're moving inertially parallel to each other, and they will just keep going straight forever. I'm assuming there's no friction. There's no other forces entering the game. However, suppose now you charge them. You put one is charged plus, which means you stroked it against your favorite cat. And the other one minus is you stroked it against some amber. By the way, you know where electron comes from? From amber, right?
So okay, somebody, people already know. Okay, good.
If you now do this, if the two now are charged, they're going to attract each other. So the trajectories would be more, so they keep moving, of course, but they experience a force. So they're going to collide into each other in some time. This idea that they're going to collide into each other, I can actually realize it, forgetting about the fact that there's a force, but imagining that these two are moving freely on, not on a plane, but on a curved surface. Because let's put them on a sphere. Let's say they both start at the equator down here, and they're both moving north along a meridian. Well, we know that even though there's no forces attracting them, they're going to meet at the pole. So this naive example shows you that, in principle, I can imagine the fact that two things are attracted into each other, either they are on a plane, but there's a force between them, or they're actually not moving on a plane, but they're moving on a curved surface that will bring them to touch at the end. Okay? This sort of reason is a simplified version of the sort of reasoning that is behind general relativity. The idea that instead of thinking gravity as a force, you think gravity as a manifestation of the fact that space-time now is curved. So the trajectories that you follow are not anymore straight lines in the Euclidean sense, but are more complicated trajectories, straight lines in a new sense called the geodesics, which means the shortest path, okay, in the curved surface. And then it's useful and to pictorially represent the curved space-time really like a cloth, like a piece of cloth with bendings and, concavities in it, so that then you can use your intuition and think how a ball would roll around in a piece of cloth with concavities, which is bent, and change its trajectory accordingly, even though there are no strings or magnets pulling the ball around. Actually, until last year, we had downstairs this little toy. There's no more there? Oh, it is still down there. Okay, good. So you can try to, it's a bit small, so your balls end up hitting each other immediately, but it's sort of nice. Anyway, so this is the picture, the intuitive picture, which is behind generativity. But as Newton taught us, the power of modern science lies in the fact that you can give a mathematical description of your thoughts, because that makes your thoughts independent of your own point of view. That makes them universal. Everybody can understand them according to their own mind. Everybody can do calculations. And there are equations describing describing this idea, and these equations can be written, even very big, can be written on a wrecked train. This is true, it's not a fake, this is in Colombia. And those are the Einstein's equations, nicely big written. You will recognize in this equation the speed of light, and g is the Newton constant that tells you how much things gravitate. The meaning of these equations is extremely simple. The meaning of the, you know the principle of conservation of energy. The initial energy is equal to the final energy. And when you do your exercises, you split the energy into kinetic energy and potential energy, and then you say the sum of the two at the beginning is equal to the sum of the two at the end, for instance, right? These equations say exactly the same thing. The right-hand side, this quantity T, tells you the energy, the total energy content of any matter, any radiation, any quantum source that at the time when Einstein wrote them wasn't that clear yet, but with the years it has become clear that that contributes as well, and it's one of the biggest paradox that we have these days to understand how to merge the two theories. So the right-hand side, T, tells you all the energy of matter that you have in your universe. The left-hand side tells you how space-time reacts, curving itself according to the quantity of energy that is present in it. So these equations can be read precisely as the total content of energy of the universe is zero. For as much matter energy you have an according change in the distribution of in the curvature of space-time to have a compensating effect. So the physics interpretation is very simple. And within these equations, in appropriate limits, you will find Newton's law of gravitation, which you probably know already. You will find there's special relativity in these equations because you see there's c, the universal speed of light. So these equations, in fact, can be beautifully derived starting purely from Newton's law, requirement of the requirements of special relativity, which we have understood already, and the mathematical framework developed by Riemann in the 19th century. These three ingredients will actually uniquely lead you to this formulation of gravity. And this formulation of gravity immediately led to beautiful understandings. For instance, there was this big puzzle at the beginning of the 20th century that had to do with the precession of the perihelion of Mercury. So a similar problem maybe 20 years or so before, no, more than that. In the 19th century, a similar problem concerning the orbit of Uranus, of Neptune, sorry, the orbit of, which one comes first? Saturn, no, Uranus comes first, right? So concerning the orbit of Uranus, that the orbit was perturbed, led a famous famous French astronomer to use Newton's law to theorize, to predict that actually there must have been an extra planet just outside the orbit of Uranus, which was perturbing the orbit of Uranus. And that was the reason why the motion of Uranus wasn't consistent with Newton's law a priori, because there was an extra body in the game. And that body was looked for and found, and it was Neptune. And that was a striking success of Newton's theory and of this scientific idea of giving predictions and then confirming them. So what happened was that then the perihelion of Mercury was proceeding in a way which wasn't consistent with Mercury's the planet which is closest to the sun. It wasn't consistent with the predictions of Newton's law, and so the same guy did the same calculations and again said, ha, There's going to be a planet. It's going to be there. Look for it. You'll find it. And he even named the planet Vulcano. But the planet was nowhere to be found, in spite of years and years of looking for it. When Einstein came up with his theory clearly led to standard Newton's gravitation at very short scales, at low energies. But then when you include the larger and larger bodies, you end up having departures from Newton's law. And including these departures, one could recalculate the precession of the perihelion of Mercury and find out that actually the result agreed with the calculations from general relativity without the need of an extra planet. So these two examples show, in one case, a victory of the theory. Newton's law was perfect. It led to a new experimental discovery, the extra planet. In the other case, the theory had reached its limit and had to be modified in order to understand what we were seeing. So the theory, right from the beginning, was being very successful. And also, right from the beginning, it was clear that the theory had some funny features within it, which are the black hole that you have heard already about. And it's interesting to know that actually Laplace already, quite a number of years before, had visualized the possibility of the existence of black bodies, because he said, suppose that the speed of light is finite, then you know there's a concept of escape velocity. The bigger the mass of a body, the more the velocity that you need in order to escape it. So if the velocity of light is finite, there must be a body in the universe that is big enough so that not even light can come out of it. That body will be completely black. And actually, this idea is perfectly realized within general relativity. And probably you know already how this works, so I don't have to give too many details. But I would like to say that there's a... So that's a pictorial representation. That's actually a picture of a black hole. Of course, you can never see the black hole itself. It's very black, but you can see the accretion disk of all the garbage that falls into it, attracted by its strong gravity, and that emits radiation because of friction in the spiral that is falling into the hole. But you might maybe not have come across this example. It actually is very easy to realize a black hole even in your house. Your mom might not be very happy. But in principle, if you look at a waterfall, that's what is called a sonic black hole. Because if you take your favorite hockey stick and you go, let's say, a meter from the waterfall, and you go, pick, you're going to have waves which propagate in all directions, towards the pole and backwards. If you go and pick much closer to the edge, the waves that are propagating backwards are going to be extremely damped. Very few waves are going to, the amplitude is going to be very damped. And once you actually reach the edge, there will be basically no waves propagating backwards. So even if you hit here, there will be no waves propagating backwards. Everything goes this way. So you can think of here as the universe outside. This is the event horizon. And this is the inside of the black hole. And as the astronaut falls into the black hole, it keeps hitting the surface of the waters. His signals arrive to the spaceship outside, dumped until it reaches the horizon. No more signals come back. And we know what has happened to him. He was in a barrel, and we hope he was luckier than the many that have tried the Niagara Falls. So you can do that example at home. All you need is to overfill your tub, your sink. So that's why I said your mom might not be very happy, but if you overfill your sink and the water then starts falling on the ground, on the floor, you can do that experiment and see that actually when you're close to the rim, there's no more waves that go inside. And then run for your life. Oh, that's something that the classical theory describes, okay? Generative. Meantime, the parallel developments of quantum mechanics were completely different. They were because what I've given so far is completely classical in the sense that it's completely deterministic. All the objects in the theory follow very well-defined trajectories. At every point of the trajectory, you can always measure the position and the velocity of the trajectory. And that's actually what you need to uniquely reconstruct the trajectory. At the same time, those other German guys, the other fellows, were telling us that actually this doesn't quite make sense. Or if it does make sense, it doesn't lead to predictions which are consistent with what you observe for very small objects such as subatomic particles. Subatomic particles seem to behave in a very different way, that if you try to measure where they are, you actually don't know where they are going. If you try to measure where they are going at what speed, you don't know where they are. It might seem confusing at first, but it actually makes perfect sense. Because how do you measure where something is? You look at it. So you bombard it with light. So I want to know where this thing is. I'm going to measure it like sending a laser, or just with my eyes, I'm going to see where it is. And of course, this thing doesn't care if it's hit by millions, trillions of photons at a time so that I can see it. Because they're so small, it doesn't even notice. But suppose that now you're taking a photon itself, or a very small, tiny subatomic particle, and now you hit it with a photon to see where it is. And now that particle is going to be bumped, for sure. It's like saying that I want to measure where, I want to see where my car is parked by thrashing against my car another car at very high speed. Hey, I might know where the car was, but I won't know where it's going after the crash or what is left of it. So to some extent, it's not the most absurd idea. It sort of makes sense. And it turns out that to take this idea into account, one has to change the way the way mechanics is described. So in terms of, instead of using classical trajectories, I measure position, I measure velocity, I know the classical trajectory, namely what? Galileo, Newton, Lagrange, Hamilton, Poincaré. Many shoulders of many giants had been teaching the world. You have to do something more subtle and give up this deterministic way of describing things and trying to imagine the world in a different way, in more probabilistic terms. Like if you are not able to know at this point where the particle is going, that means you cannot really reconstruct this trajectory. You might know that the particle initially was here, at the end is here, but you don't really know where it has been in the meantime. So you have to introduce this idea of superposition of trajectories. Namely, the particle could have taken a number of different paths. You don't know which one it has taken. This doesn't mean that the theory is not predictive. The theory is perfectly predictive, but in a different sense than the standard one, in this probabilistic sense. So the theory predicts not where the particle is going to be, but with which probability the particle is going to be there. Okay? So this is the change in state of mind that the people had to face at that point, and it wasn't easy at all. Like the first interpretation of quantum mechanics was, well, these fuzzy trajectories, what they really mean is that the, let's say I'm doing an electron, well, what that means is that the electron is really, how do you say, blurred, is squashed all over space in all these possible directions. It's really being squashed, it's not anymore a point. This was the initial interpretation, for instance, of a number of guys, and it was Max Born that initially in the 20s insisted for going towards a purely probabilistic interpretation, which then became the standard Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, which is still nowadays questioned. There's a lot of people investigating the possibility that actually this is certainly an extremely well set up tool to describe physics at those scales, but maybe it's not really what is happening. We are missing something. And that's the realm of investigation that the guys in Foundation, and Foundations of Quantum Mechanics, address. Oh, in particular, technically, the fact that you can measure one variable and then you don't know anything about the other variable is called the incompatibility of these observables. Oh, one of the beautiful consequences of these ideas of quantum mechanics is that it might lead to discrete properties of nature. We have already seen some, the fact that the atoms, that the electrons in an atom can only have a finite number of positions where they can sit, and you probably studied this already in school in your chemistry class. So there's this discreteness in the energy levels. There's also the discreteness, for instance, in the spin of the electron. We know the electron spins around this axis. Well, that's a pictorial image of what he's really doing. Nobody knows. But if he does that, certainly he's doing it only in two possible ways, which was this extraordinary experiment by Stern and Gerlach in 1921, which is probably the initial example to understand quantum mechanics of most quantum mechanical books. So you will come across this experiment very soon. Okay, so what are the... So let me stress once again that these two theories, which apply to different domains, are extraordinarily successful. By extraordinary, I really mean it. Namely, In its application to electromagnetism, to the interaction between charged electrons and photons, quantum mechanics leads to calculations that you can compute 17 digits, match them with experiment, and get the same number up to all those digits. Generativity, very similar situation. You can study this perihelion of Mercury. You can study the slowing down of a neutron star. You get amazing results. So the two theories are extremely robust and beautiful. But they give us pictures of the world which are completely different. So the mind-breaking, how do you say, mind-blowing new idea of generativity is that space-time is not anymore a fixed stage where things happen, but it participates to the action. Space-time is dynamical itself. If you change, if you move around in space-time, space-time moves according to you. Very, very small. You won't see it because you have walked around, but it does. So that's something that changes completely the way physics was constructed, and it also changes the way quantum mechanics is constructed. Because in quantum mechanics, space-time is absolutely rigid and fixed, and non-dynamical at all. Quantum mechanics, on the other hand, teaches us that things are not smooth, deterministic. Things are quantized, discrete. Things are fuzzy. And this is something that generativity has absolutely not built in. Generativity is extremely deterministic, extremely classical. So how can we put together these two pictures? How can we have an intuition of what a quantum space-time could look like? Well, naively, without discussing any possible theories, let's just try to make some thought experiment. What could be the quantum of gravity? So we know that the quantum of the electromagnetic field, for instance, is the photon. What could be the equivalent for gravity? Well, we know that gravity is about space-time. So it tells you the dynamics of gravity is truly the dynamics of space-time. So a quantum of gravity should be, in some sense, a quantum of space-time. So a minimal excitation that you can have in space-time, a minimal grain of space. Like an electron can be so close and not closer to the nucleus, maybe also space can be only as close to zero in volume and not more. So the concept of grains of space. But this naive picture, how can we then reconcile this naive picture with the fact that we certainly experience at every scale that we measure it, there's no doubt space is smooth, not grainy at all. Well, that's when you go on holidays in the tropics and you came out with these nice pictures, that actually is the same situation as if you were walking on one of these beautiful beaches. It's extremely smooth, I can guarantee you. It's extremely smooth when you're walking on it. But if you zoom out on a little detail, you're going to see that actually is extremely grainy. Now, in the case of gravity, the absurdity is that these grains have to be so small that basically to a proton, they're way smaller than a proton is to us. This number is ludicrously small, okay? So one might say, okay, but maybe this picture doesn't make so much sense. If anything happens, such as grains of space, it happens at a scale which is never going to be accessible. How can we make sense of this? Well, there is a possibility that in spite of the fact that it happens at such a short scale, it can nevertheless be visible because this effect might accumulate given the huge distances that are out there in the universe. And I will come back to this point and whether these kind of effects are visible or not. But this is just a naive picture. Then how do we try to make this into a theory? How do we introduce mathematics within it? So as I said at the beginning, unfortunately, there's no direct experiments. There's no guidance, really, as there was before. One of the advantages of quantum mechanics that helped her developing so fast and so well was the fact that any idea people would come with, they would go next door, literally next door to their lab, set up an experiment and verify it immediately. They had tons of experimental data that could help them discerning between the various possibilities. Even more so for the creation of the so-called standard model of particle physics, they had throngs of data. They had even more than they wanted. And they were smart enough to figure out a way to understand them in terms of very simple principles. A similar situation is still true today, and it concerns cosmology. There's throngs of data about cosmology, about galaxy formations and everything. However, apart from the consensus on a standard model of cosmology, still very weak. Somehow, either the data are not as illuminating or the people are not as smart, but somehow similar situation, slower progress. Comes to quantum gravity, no progress at all because there's no direct guidance from the experiments. People are really lost in the dark. And they've been lost in the dark for basically 70 years because, well, now more maybe, because this idea that the two theories should have been somehow put together came into the mind of people like Oscar Klein right after Einstein wrote down his equations in 1516. So I think Klein's paper on possible unification with electromagnetism and discussion of possible quantum description of general relativity of 1819 or 1820. So soon after, people started realizing that maybe it would have been exciting to try to merge the two. So today, there's two main approaches to this. There's many approaches, actually. The two most known ones, actually, the most known one is string theory. And string theory is deeply rooted into the particle physics approach. So the particle physics approach, which led to the construction of the standard model, as I said, was extremely successful, thanks to the huge experimental data that they had at disposal, but was extremely successful in describing all the other three fundamental forces of nature which we understand these days, namely the electromagnetic force, the weak nuclear force, and the strong nuclear force. So people thought, okay, we've explained three out of the four that we see, let's try the fourth one. And from that legacy, string theory was born. The other approach that I'm going to talk about and that you haven't heard so much is called loop quantum gravity. That's a far minoritary approach. So numbers, maybe there's, including students, maybe 3,000 people working on string theory in the world, roughly speaking. There might be around 300 in loop quantum gravity. So much smaller. Nevertheless, also string theory is much smaller with respect to high temperature superconductivity, which easily counts, I don't know, 10, 15,000 researchers in the world, I'm sure. So there's much bigger fields in theoretical physics. This loop quantum gravity approach comes, on the other hand, not so much from the particle physics legacy, but rather from general relativity. And so the difference is that while string theory tries to push the many ideas of particle physics in general relativity, the other approach is sort of the opposite, tries to extend to quantum mechanics many of these ideas of general relativity. So they end up being very different in what they look like. However, apart from these two, there's many other approaches which deserve interest. And as I said, are vital to the field, because in the absence of experimental guidance, one of the few hopes that we have to make progress is to have wide ideas from a variety of fields, from a variety of different perspectives, and hopefully merging together some of these make real progress. So it's very good that there's many other directions which are investigated, which maybe you hear less, especially in popular books, but already here at Perimeter, there's people working in other approaches known as causal sets or dynamical triangulations. And I just want you to be aware that there's, with the numbers, of course, decrease even more. Dynamical triangulation instead of 300 would be now 50 people, maybe not even. Causal sets would be 5 people and so on. But nevertheless, it's important to have different ideas. Now, I'm not going to be biased at all in my preferences, of course. I'm going to be extremely unbiased. And I'm going to talk first about string theory. So, very unbiased.
That was great. How was it?
Oh,
I need a little message problem, but I need to use the comment on the next slide. So don't talk louder. Why do I say the dark side? Not because I am certainly because I'm biased.
But there is an analogy which, if you've seen the movie, you might appreciate. String theory is really like dark side, very powerful and very fascinating. The reason for this is precisely its legacy in the particle physics developments, which were extremely powerful and explained beautifully a lot of open questions that we had. So that methodology, those mathematical fields have been extended directly, trying to apply them to general relativity. The problem, I don't know if it's a problem, sometimes it's considered to be a virtue, but for me it's still a bit of a problem, is that the theory, in order to make sense, requires a number of extra features, which a priori you might not be willing to require while just trying to quantize general relativity. And these features are extra dimensions and supersymmetry. And I'm certain that in your popular book you read about these things like if they were there, like they are the only idea around, but it's not. I really have to. I don't even stop at some point. So it's important to realize that these ideas were born out of limitations of the theory, and smartly enough were turned into virtues. For instance, the reason for extra dimensions comes from the fact that if you write down the basic equation of, well, now I'm simplifying a lot. I hope no string theorist hears me, but I just want to give you the logic. But if you write down one of the main equations of string theory, you realize that it doesn't make so much sense if we live in 3 + 1 dimensions, 3 space plus 1 time, but it does make more sense if you live in 26 dimensions. That was the initial number of dimensions. But then you also realize that this theory describes particles that go faster than the speed of light. So that's also not enough making sense. But then maybe you can say that for each particle, there's a supersymmetric particle, or supersymmetric partner, so it is called. And the combined effect of this enriched theory is to get rid of the problem of the particles which go faster than light. So you have a technical problem, you fix it, you have a new technical problem, you fix it again, and you try to make a virtue out of this by saying that then maybe if this is the fundamental theory of the universe, we really live in our really fundamental world is higher dimensional, and for some reasons, there's different points of view, compactifications, brain world scenarios, we only live in this three-dimensional space. A beautiful consequence of this is that in principle, you might hope to be able to test these ideas. And a lot of very good researchers are actually trying to develop ways to actually find consequences in our three-dimensional world coming from higher dimensions so that these ideas can be sort of tested, which is the key of all these developments. If it's tested, then you can say, okay, wait a second. I had to add all this paraphernalia of extra stuff, but actually he ended up giving me a prediction, which I've seen. So maybe I'm really doing something that is a good description of nature. So in this sense, trying to get predictions is crucial. It seems very hard to do so, but it's good and it's a virtue of the theory that there's many technical tools and many researchers working on this and trying to find out whether there's any possible evidence that you can draw out of the theory. One limitation that for personal views I find important is the fact that the theory does not address in itself the question of quantum spacetime as I have posed it here. So it doesn't care so much about wondering what are, at least in its standard formulation, it doesn't care so much about what are the true quanta of spacetime, and it contents itself with quantizing little ripples of spacetime over a fixed classical background. So from my perspective, that's one of the limitations which have to be worked on. Oh, this is a technical aside, but I think it's useful to make it because nobody has raised this question. By the way, you're welcome to interrupt me with questions at any moment. But people, of course, have tried to apply the standard techniques of quantum mechanics to gravity. And there's a very specific reason why that fails. So when you apply quantum mechanics to fields, as I said, there's something called the standard model. The standard model is a very beautiful description of the other three interaction forces. And it applies quantum mechanics to these forces. The same application of quantum mechanics to general relativity fails, gives meaningless answers, which are sort of similar to the kind of meaningless answers that you get from general relativity on its own when you poke it too much. Namely, you get infinite out of your questions. You ask, what is the amplitude for this phenomenon to happen? Because remember that that's the kind of questions you ask in quantum mechanics. You don't ask, where is that particle going to be? You ask, what is the probability, or better, the probability amplitude for that particle to be some other place? When you ask these kind of questions in the naive application of quantum mechanics to general relativity, you get again infinite as answers, which is telling you that this naive application is going wrong and you have to be more subtle. And string theory is a way of being way less subtle. So it's a very sophisticated approach. Oh, the alternative, I need the music again. And again, not being biased. Am I getting any music here? There you go. The music of the good guys, right? You guys have seen this movie, right? Don't make me feel old. And you know this one here in Algolfi. That one has been my thesis advisor, and a biastical is in Penn State. Not a long drive from here. So these people came out with a very different idea about the way of applying the principle of quantum mechanics to general relativity, which was instead of trying to apply it to the waves, to the little ripples of space-time on a. So I don't know if that concept was actually clear. When I said that you try to apply the standard quantum mechanics and then you only quantize the ripples over a fixed space-time, maybe it rephrased in different terms, what it means is the following, that instead of asking the question, what are the quantum of space-time, the whole quantum of space-time, as I was asking it before, you say, okay, let me assume, general relativity tells me that space-time is dynamical as a whole thing. But let me nevertheless assume that I can imagine that space-time, at least as a mathematical tool, I can imagine the space-time is actually not dynamical, but what is dynamical is only perturbations around the space-time that is fixed. So I take a fixed classical space-time, but then I allow for very small waves, very small ripples over this space-time. So we go from a description where instead of having ice, now the ice is melting and there's little waves on top. And then you apply the principle of quantum mechanics only to these little waves on top. Okay, that was what I meant. Whereas we're trying to be more ambitious, we would like these ice to have melted completely and to apply the principle of quantum mechanics to the all dynamical surface of the world. And remember that we said one of the striking consequences of quantum mechanics had to deal with discreteness properties of nature which emerge in some situation. Well, within this theory of loop quantum gravity, similar features emerge. Namely, space is discrete in the following sense, that if you look at a minimal you have this concept of minimal quanta of space, which are more or less you can think of as little grains glued together. But these little grains cannot be as small as they want, just as an electron cannot be as close as it wants to the nucleus. These grains have to be a definite spectrum for their volume. Just an electron has to have a definite spectrum of distances from the nucleus. This concept of discrete spectrum applies not just to the volume of this grain, but also to the surface, to the area of the surface of the grain. And the way this is described is in terms of mathematical objects which are extremely different from the standard object used in quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, which is the application of quantum mechanics to the other three fundamental forces which leads to the standard model. The way it is described is in terms of graphs. So what is a graph? A graph is a set of nodes. I don't know, have you been told about these things already maybe? Or should they? So imagine a set of nodes connected by links. Okay, that's just the simplest definition of a graph. And if Steve Flamia hears me, he's going to kill me because he has these huge words for graphs. I think something is interfering here. So this is a graph, and this is the fundamental object of the theory. So it's not a theory which is going to describe in terms of particles. You see, the quanta of the electromagnetic fields are photons. You have one photon of that energy, another photon of that energy. Maybe you have three photons of this third energy here. Those are the fundamental quanta, photons. Same with the electron field. The quanta of the electron field are the electrons. So things are described in terms of particles in our standard understanding. Here, no. Things are described in terms of these graphs. So it might already tell you, okay, this is a very different picture. It might be hard to ask standard questions within this theory, like what is the amplitude for two electrons to scatter against each other? And in fact, it is so. This theory is hard to use to address standard questions. It is, in a sense, tailored to the idea of quantizing general relativity, because what general relativity teaches us is that what matters is not where things are, because there's no absolute space-time to refer things to, but where things are with respect to each other. And if you think about it, a graph, all it cares about, you don't care where this point is, if it's here or there. All you care is where it is connected to. It's links. So a graph encodes in itself this idea that what really matters is the relationism. So the relation between things, more than where things are. Nevertheless, the difficulty is to describe standard things. So in fact, the theory is far beyond string theory in a number of aspects. A number of questions, preliminary questions towards the final quantum gravity theory can already be asked in string theory. That's not quite the case in group quantum gravity, partly because of less researchers working on it. But I really think because the standard tools of particle physics do not apply in this case, and one has to develop a new understanding. A new understanding which to some extent is needed so much also in classical general relativity, because people don't appreciate it. But the revolution of general relativity really kills a lot of our understanding of physics. People in the 19th century, to characterize a particle, might have wondered, what is the mass of the particle? Tell me the mass of the particle. I know what it is. Then special relativity told them that that's not quite the case, because, you know, the mass of the particle is not necessarily an invariant concept. You heard these things, right? There's an invariant mass concept. You heard these things, right? So what matters really is the energy of a particle. Well, but then you say, okay, that's okay. Okay, don't tell me about the mass. Tell me the energy of the particle. That's nevertheless a concept which is hundreds of years old. I know what to deal with it. Well, in general relativity, it turns out that not even the energy is a well-defined concept. You have to restrict yourself to a special class of solutions of the theory in order to make sense of this concept. The theory in itself has not such a simple notion of energy as in the standard case. In fact, as I told you, if you want the simple interpretation of the theory, is that it's just telling you that the energy is zero. So the situation is more subtle. So to some extent, the fact that the questions are much harder to even formulate now, comes really from the fact that we are giving a lot of credit to the aspects of general relativity. So they will be also hard to ask in the classical theory. So those are the graphs, set of nodes linked to each other. And as I was saying, this is nice because it makes us think that what really matters is just the way these nodes are linked together, which is similar to the spirit of general relativity. So this leads not only to a concept of discreteness of space, as I described. So remember, discreteness of space, it's similar to the discreteness of the n quantum number for the electrons, so the radial quantum number for the electrons in an atom. You also have a concept of fuzziness, of incompatibility of observables. You remember the position and the momentum cannot be measured at the same time. This shows up at the level of geometry of the theory in a very simple way that you can understand. So the simplest toy model that you can build to study these grains of space is that you can build the simplest three-dimensional discrete object, which is a pyramid with a triangular basis, so not a not an Egyptian pyramid, and this is called a tetrahedron because it has four faces. If you guys play Dungeons and Dragons or other role games, this would be a four-faced die. I feel like a nerd here. You should be the nerds, not me. So, classically, Euclides, 2,500 and so years ago, tells us that a tetrahedron comes in a number of different shapes. How many are the parameters that characterize the different shapes of the tetrahedron? Six. If you give me, so you see this has six edges. It has four faces, but six edges. The edges are these things, okay? There's six of them. If you tell me, if you change the length of one of these edges, the shape of the tetrahedron changes. You agree? It turns out that if you tell me the edges, sorry, if you tell me the length of all six edges, then the shape of the tetrahedron is uniquely fixed. So its classical geometry is classically, uniquely determined. Which is like saying that the trajectory of a classical particle is uniquely determined once you measure position and momentum. So classically, you have two variables. Classically, you have two variables. You have the position at a point x, the velocity at a point x, sorry, the position at a time t, the velocity at a time t, and this allows you to reconstruct where a particle is, where it is going, to reconstruct its trajectory. So if it's in three dimensions, you have 3 plus 3, you have 6 variables. However, you know that the quantum theory only allows you to measure 3. You cannot measure simultaneously the position and the velocity. So quantum mechanically, we'll end up having only 3 possible measurable quantities at the same time. So the trajectory is fuzzy. Something extremely similar happens to this theory of loop quantum gravity. This toy model, this little quantum tetrahedron, classically will have 6 variables, the 6 edge lengths, LE, the edge lengths. But quantum mechanically, you're allowed only to measure 5 of these things. And you know that as for this trajectory, if you measure the position, you don't know at all the velocity. Similarly here, if you measure all 5 quantum observables, then the 6th observable, you will have no idea what its value is. It will not be picked on any value. So this object would be not classical at all. So just as the trajectories become fuzzy, when you go from classical mechanics to quantum mechanics, geometry becomes fuzzy when you try to apply quantum mechanics to general relativity according to the rules suggested by loop quantum gravity. So we have discreteness and we have fuzziness. Similar to standard quantum mechanics, that you have discreteness and fuzziness as well. Oh, that thing that I drew at the beginning is an example of what is called a spin foam. What is a spin foam? So this picture with the quantum tetrahedron, it's a toy model. But of course, the question one is interested in is, well, how is this grain, how is this minimal quantum of space going to evolve? What is the evolution of this, right? The evolution, this is maybe technical, but is studied through an object which is called the Hamiltonian. And this is a standard way of formulating quantum mechanics, which you will encounter very soon once you start studying, even without fields and forces, just a standard quantum mechanics. An Hamiltonian is an object which actually can be used also to formulate classical mechanics. You're all familiar with F equal ma. You're all familiar to F equal ma. That's Newton. That's 1660-something. Smart guys came after him. One of them was Lagrange, Italian, by the way, was born in Turin, even though the French don't allow for these things to be known. So proud. Lagrange and Euler, and they said, okay, look, we can be more sophisticated than this. We can include these equations into a more general set of equations, which is cooler, which allows us to deal with more system, to understand more things. And in order to set up that system of equation, they introduced a function which was called in honor to Lagrange, the Lagrangian function, and then shortly after, Scottish guy, Hamilton. Hamilton, Scottish, I think. Scottish guy came and, what was it? I think so. Irish? I don't know. So he came and said, we can be even more sophisticated and introduce an even better way that includes this one, includes that one, and allows us to study, for instance, symmetries also in a very nice way. And that object in his honor is called the Hamiltonian. So this object can be used to describe classical physics and is the simplest way to start doing also quantum mechanics. You have heard of the Schrödinger equation. The Schrödinger equation is based on giving a quantum representation to this object here, the Hamiltonian, introduced classically to describe classical physics. The Hamiltonian in loop quantum gravity has a weird property, because now you are dealing with a theory which is not in terms of particles. So the dynamics is not going to be making these particles move around, but you're dealing with a theory which is made out of graphs. So what the dynamics is going to be is going to make these graphs change. And a way this graph changes, for instance, that you pick up a node and you blow it up into a little triangle like this with two new nodes. So if you do this to an initial graph, let's say this graph here, focus on this node up here, it opens up like this and then continues like that under the evolution. So if you draw the evolution in the vertical axis, it's going to look like this. You start with this graph, you act with the Hamiltonian, it opens up, the graph changes to this one. And if you count the faces of this graph now, it has extra faces inside. There's this new face in here. There's this cylindrical face outside. And more in general, what a graph like this is going to look like is something like this. And this is called a spin foam. It's something that comes from loop quantum gravity. And the reason it's called a spin foam is twofold. First of all, because John Wheeler, one of the most visionary physicists of our century, died this year, very recently. But he died very recently. He suggested at some point that applying quantum mechanics to generativity would have made, at some point, I mean in the 60s, would have made our concept of space and time fuzzier. So space and time at small scales would have looked like a foam. And he described in his book this concept of a space-time foam. These graphs, which we use in loop quantum gravity, are actually not empty. They are labeled, they are colored. And the labels attached to these graphs are spins, such as the spins in quantum mechanics. And that's why this particular realization of Wheeler's idea is called the spin foam. That's just to explain the name. And I think the clock is covered, so I don't know. Perfect. Because I think I can come to my conclusions to say that, as I said, the theory still has a lot to be developed, but this idea is very nice in the sense that it can allow to improve the problem of infinities that we encounter, both in classical generativity and in trying to apply quantum mechanics to fields, to the field of gravity naively, because if you now imagine that there's a minimal quantum of space, that there's a minimal grain of space, that you cannot be smaller than that, now when you're going to ask the question if a cloud collapses, even though it's very large, now you may imagine that you won't be able anymore to reach a singular point, an infinitesimal point with infinite density, which was the problem with generativity. All you can do, the best you can do, is to reach one of these minimal grains. So the fact that at the microscopic level, at the Planck scale, the theory is discrete, might allow you to avoid singularities precisely, and this is a little aside, as quantum mechanics avoids the singularity of the classical instability of the hydrogen atom, which is something that you will come to know about, I think, soon. A charged particle in orbit emits, radiates. So in principle, if you have an electron orbiting around the nucleus because it's charged, because it's orbiting, so it's accelerating, it should emit radiation, lose potential energy, collapse into the nucleus. This was called the atom instability. The reason why this doesn't happen, and the only reason why it does not happen, is Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which tells you that you cannot be too close to each other, the electron cannot. There are, it's more sophisticated than that at the end of the day, because the electron can be molten in a proton to the through the weak and strong forces to form a neutron. But the, at the level of the understanding that people had in the 20s, it was crucial to realize the role of the Heisenberg picture, of the Heisenberg uncertainty relation, in to avoid this kind of catastrophe. And here a similar thing might play a similar role, because there's a minimal uncertainty in the position of a particle, because there's a minimal grain of space. Similarly, you might avoid this singularity of ending up in a single point with infinite densities. And on the other hand, the fact that the structure is grainy, fuzzy, and discrete at the Planck scale might affect the propagation of matter, especially when matter propagates along big distances. So the scale is very small, so you won't see it if you walk on these grains for a little time. But if you let a ball roll on a surface which is not perfectly plane for long enough, maybe you're going to start seeing some bubbling of this ball. And so possibly this idea of discreteness of space can have observable consequences. And I'm not going to show you the plots of people that have hoped that we had already signals showing of things like this. But this has led to a very interesting research direction, which is called deformed special relativity, in which you try to implement this idea of discreteness of space, not within a full theory of quantum gravity, but just as a model of how special relativity could be different if instead of being written on a continuous, smooth, flat, and fixed background, it would be written on a background which carries this idea of a minimal length on the Planck scale. And if I'm close to the end, I think I can finish here for sure.
Questions? It's all perfectly clear. All the answers. So there's quantum gravity right here.
It helps to get it going by leaving unanswered questions above and bringing them up here. So, where are you?
Okay, well, I have a question. It's not about this, but before you went into the physics, was there ever anything that you, like, did you ever consider, like, stopping physics and going into some other department, studying something else? Or, like, did you always know that you wanted to do physics?
I think I was nerdy enough to be very attracted by, as I said, at least astronomy all the time. So I got a lot of help from popular books and from sometimes even TV programs in trying to understand whether really those questions attracted me. And before starting university, I remember that when I was still at high school, I went once to a physics class, see whether if I liked the atmosphere there. I remember that I was buying sort of books that were sort of more advanced to see if I liked them. I did that at some point, one hesitation right before starting university. Actually, that's good. Even though you're very motivated, it's good that at some point you doubt. You always have to doubt, right? Ask yourself some questions. So at some point I said, maybe I actually want to draw planes instead of doing physics. And this kind of, then like somebody explained me that nobody draws planes anyway, anymore. At most you draw a screw maybe. At most you draw the screw of a plane together in your team of 3,000 people. So that sort of made it look less romantic to me. But once I started, as I said, it was very important for me to have the feeling that many opportunities were open in front of me. And especially, I stress that it would be very nice if you don't start doing physics with the idea that you're going to do research. But it's very important to mature that decision with the years and not having it as the meaning of your choice. Your choice should not be taken on the purposes of the fact that you want to do necessarily that job, because more things could come out during your career, and it's important that you value all the options. So, for instance, in my case, at some point, I consider different fields within the theory, I consider different alternative jobs. So it's important that, I think for personal reasons, I think it's important that you don't feel that you have to go straight along the road, just keep going straight, because there's this beautiful poem by a Spanish guy, Machado. It's a beautiful poem, and it actually it matches nicely also with what generativity teaches us. The poem says that there's no path in life. The path is just made by your footsteps. It's just made by walking. So there's no wrong turn you can take, dead ends. As long as you keep walking, looking for your own path, you'll be fine. Which is a nice idea, because it's a nice idea also to describe generativity, because more or less that's what it's telling you. There's no absolute space-time. Space-time changes as you move through it, because you change the distribution of energy in the universe as you move along, and space-time deforms itself accordingly. So you're going towards very important decisions. You have to know that the decisions are going to be harder and harder. This is one of the things that struck me so much, and I thought it was so unfair. You think that actually choosing your program in university is a hard decision? No, it's going to be worse and worse. It's going to be more important, require more responsibility, be harder to make. So no worries. Just keep yourself an open mind, and you'll be very fine.
All right. Thank you so much.